Time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning David Nywert. David Nywert is a freelance journalist and author based in Seattle. His reportage for MSNBC.com on domestic terrorism won the National Press Club Award for Distinguished Online Journalism in 2000. He is the founder of the award-winning weblog Orkinus and the managing editor of Crooks and Liars. And he is the author of four books, including Strawberry Days, How Internment Destroyed a Japanese-American Community, Death on the 4th of July, The Story of a Killing, a Trial, and Hate Crime in America, In God's Country, The Patriot Movement and the Pacific Northwest. And he is here to talk about his new book, The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. David, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Hey, really, it's a pleasure, Mike.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right?
Well, a lot of it had to do with my background and working as a journalist here in the Northwest. I spent a lot of time, especially in the 90s, writing about the extremist right. I come from Idaho and grew up in Idaho and watched was in the panhandle when the Aryan Nations folks moved in the late 70s. And watched that whole scene develop through the 80s, through the bombings and the bank robberies and the hate crimes and stuff like that. And, spent a lot of time, especially getting into the 90s when the militia movement came around, spent a lot of time going to these people and trying to figure out what made them tick. Interviewing them, going to their gatherings, listening to what they were preaching. And the disturbing thing that I saw happening, especially in the 90s, I grew up a Goldwater Republican family in southern Idaho, and for me there was always a pretty clear, bright line between mainstream conservatives and these far-right extremists who populated the sort of fringe parts of our state. And what I saw starting to happen in the 1990s was that line breaking down. I saw particularly a lot of ideas and agendas and talking points that I was originally hearing at militia meetings and even Aryan congresses working their way into mainstream conservative talking points. And this to me was not just an interesting development, but a disturbing one. I saw it particularly when I was working at MSNBC between 96 and 2000, and one of my regular jobs was to download video from the cable operation, which was back east. And it was astonishing to me how many of these people, particularly, Barbara Olson and Coulter, these people that were coming on MSNBC to talk about Bill Clinton's impeachment were sitting there repeating things that I had first heard people talking about at militia meetings in the early 90s. Talk about, the MENA drug running and the nefarious conspiracy to kill Vince Foster and blah, 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 blah. All of these various conspiracy theories, especially the New World Order conspiracy theories that the militia movement built around Clinton. And I first wrote about this. I was writing for Salon.com at the time, and I did a piece for Salon on this, and they decided not to go there with that story. But I hung on to it, and I kept watching this migration of ideas from the far right into the mainstream. And so I kept writing about it, and it became one of the main subjects of my blog, Orsinus, when I started up in January 2003. And since then, I've just been basically continuing to collect evidence and sort of gather wool on this point. But the other thing that became especially disturbing to me was not just the actual talking points, but sort of the attitudes that are common on the far right became increasingly common within mainstream conservatism. And this is where eliminationism comes in. You know, basically the solution that the far right has to all of the world's countries is just, or all of the world's problems is to just get rid of everybody who is a problem, particularly liberals, but let's get rid of the gays, lesbians, and Latino immigrants. You know, let's deport them all, put them in concentration camps, do whatever we need to do to get rid of them. This is the essence of eliminationism. And, I've been increasingly hearing that sort of talk within the mainstream right in the past 10 years. You know, Rush Limbaugh joking that, you know, well, we don't need to get rid of all the liberals. We can keep a few around for museum pieces so people can see what they look like and stuff like that. You know, jokes, ha-ha, very funny stuff. And, of course, what people don't stop to think about is that in order to find that joke funny, you have to actually have those attitudes in the first place. And that to me is deeply disturbing. You know, that this idea that that we don't engage in discourse with our political opponents, we just strive to eliminate them altogether. It's not only profoundly un-American; it's deeply anti-democratic and just against everything that I was raised to think this country stands for. So now, you know, I mean, part of my migration in the past 20 or so years is that I've become a full-fledged liberal, not so much by choice, but sort of I migrated there because those you could just see all this stuff happening, and it's I think it's disturbing to anybody who has any kind of conscience at all.
So is the term eliminationist, is that something you coined, or did that come from somewhere else?
I got that from, I actually picked this up from Daniel Jonah Goldhagen's book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, which is about how ordinary Germans played a major role in making the Holocaust happen. And he used it to describe the sort of unique nature of the anti-Semitism that was extant in Germany prior to the 1930s. And I read this book at the time that I was researching Strawberry Days, my book on the Japanese-American internment, and I couldn't help but be struck by, you know, I was intrigued by this idea of eliminationism, and he doesn't really define it in the book. He more describes it than anything. And I've written to Goldhagen a couple of times and tried to get him to give me an actual definition for the word as he knows it, but he's politely declined or something. At any rate, I was struck by, you know, the similarities between that and the stuff that I was reading, pulling out of these archives, describing the anti-Japanese campaign between about 1905 and 1924 in this country, and the kind of rhetoric that was very common. In it, you know, compare human beings to vermin and diseases. This is a very common feature of eliminationist rhetoric. Openly wish, often in a sort of semi-jocular fashion, for their utter elimination, or in sometimes completely seriously. And, you know, the eliminationism isn't necessarily exterminationist. A lot of times it's let's deport them all, which is what we're currently hearing with it's the common right-wing solution for dealing with the illegal immigration problem. And, you know, once I started thinking about it, this as a concept, I thought, well, I also have a lot of background in writing about the history of the American West since, you know, I grew up in Idaho and I've always been kind of a little history buff. And anybody who knows the history of the American Indian Wars knows that eliminationism was very much a common feature of that struggle. The classic case being, you know, Colonel Shivington, prior to the Sand Creek Massacre, exhorting his men, nits make lice, upon which hearing the men were thus inspired to slaughter women and children, as well as the Braves, very few Braves who happened to be there at Sand Creek. At any rate, and that's a classic case, but you can find this sort of rhetoric during the lynching era, between about 1890 and 1940, when we lynched literally thousands of African American men in this country, supposedly because they represented a threat of rape of the purity of white women, or pure white women. And, you know, they're all the there's obviously the Asian American eliminationism, but even into present day, it's very much a force. I think hate crimes are a classic example of eliminationism in action, because the whole purpose of hate crimes is to drive these people out, drive people out of your community, and to expel them, to eliminate them. And that's, so, you know, we hear a lot of eliminationist rhetoric directed towards gays and lesbians these days, as well as Latino immigrants and ultimately even just liberals. I mean, we're hearing a lot of anti-liberal eliminationist talk. You know, you can buy the bumper sticker from various right-wing sites that give you a liberal hunting license. You know, and this kind of stuff, you know, it's really pervasive throughout the right. And it's one of the distinguishing things between left-wing rhetoric and right-wing rhetoric. You don't find eliminationism very common, even among some of the more hateful expressions that come popping up on the left. You know, there is a lot of, especially, I think, towards the end of Bush's tenure, there was a lot of fairly hateful rhetoric directed towards the individuals within the Bush administration, including Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney. But rarely do you ever hear a liberal talking about how they wish they could do away with all the conservatives, all the right-wingers. But that's a very common thing on the right, to wish that they could do away with all the folks on the left. And, you know, I think it's a real problem. I think it's, partly because it really represents what I call the death of discourse. You know, when you can't have a conversation with somebody who's just wishing you were dead or wishing you were gone or wishing you were for your elimination. That's the opposite of discourse. You can't exchange ideas with someone like that. And I think that's a real problem for a country that's based on, you know, democratic discourse.
So how do you define hate talk?
Well, hate talk was kind of a handy word that we used. I actually use it relatively little in the book. Mostly it was a sort of another way to say eliminationist rhetoric. But hate talk is fundamentally eliminationist in nature, you know, what we call hate speech. You know, hate speech is protected speech in this country. And so part of the problem with dealing with hate speech is, well, how do you stand up to it? And how do you deal with it? And ultimately, the only solution to bad speech is more speech. And kind of that's what this book is about providing that more speech to stand up to this kind of hate speech.
So if here in the U.S., if we've always had amongst the population a certain percentage of eliminationists, what are the conditions that have allowed it to bloom so much of late over the last 10 years?
Well, I think that some of it has to do with the politics of power. You know, I think that in a lot of cases, I mean, basically what's been going on is that the American right doesn't really have, it likes to pretend it does. I mean, we hear from them all the time that this is a center-right country, but if you actually look at the demographics of the country, it's pretty much a center-left country. And they've been able to obtain power and get power by doing a lot of propagandizing on the air, by putting up this terrific media machine that propagandizes their talking points on a massive basis. And often they've been able to consistently sort of shove the Overton window of our national discourse to the right, and with it sort of the center of our political gravity. And I think they've been successful at doing that, even though the country really isn't center-right. I think the country is very much, you know, tends to be pretty well-centered, and if anything, especially on social issues, somewhat liberal. But And so, well, let me put it this way. A lot of their electoral success is dependent upon this, this propaganda machine. But it's started to wear thin. And in order for the propaganda machine to work, the talkers, the Rush Limbaughs, the Michael Savages, and the Glenn Becks, they constantly have to sort of push the envelope of discourse. They're always, you know, in order to keep the ratings up, they have to come up with something more and more outrageous every day, you know. They've pushed that envelope so far to the point that now they're right up there next to Ku Klux Klan land in terms of having to resort to just outright bigotry to be able to push that envelope. I mean, listen to Limbaugh in the last month or so. He's just doing outright race baiting that's straight out of like Theodore Bilbo back in the 1930s. It's just amazing. He's been talking about, talking about Obama with a bone in his nose and stuff like this. I mean, you just can't get any more offensive. And it's pretty amazing to me that people are still willing to put up with that. And not only that, he's so successfully pushed that envelope to the right now that people are kind of like unsurprised that he's doing this. Oh, yeah, it's just Rush, you know, he's just doing his thing sort of thing. And, you know, that's not healthy, if you ask me. But.
So it sounds like a lot of this is coming out, or at least being amplified by media outlets like Fox, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. Other major media outlets that are also supporting this?
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, Lou Dobbs is probably one of the worst. He shows up on CNN. Michael Savage, in particular, has really gone off the wheel in the last month. I mean, he's out there talking about concentration camps, that Obama is planning concentration camps for conservatives, and which is crazy talk straight out of the militias of the 1990s. That was what they were talking about. And, you know, and Glenn Beck has promoted this idea as well, although he did do a segment. He had told his audience for the better part of a month, I can't disprove that these things exist. We're trying really hard, but I can't disprove them, you know, which is like saying, I heard, Glenn Beck, has sexual peccadilloes with dogs, but I can't disprove it, and saying that for a month, and then later coming up, well, we've now been able to disprove that Glenn Beck has intercourse with dogs. You know, I mean, you might as well do that, because this is what he did, only it was for something that's even more outrageous, because when you tell people that the government is planning to build concentration camps, this has a profoundly unhinging effect on people. And in fact, we saw it in Pittsburgh earlier this year. A young man named Richard Poplawski, who was a fan of Glenn Beck's, and had in fact posted one of the videos of Beck talking about FEMA concentration camps onto the website of Stormfront.org, the neo-Nazi website forum. And about 2 weeks before, or 2 weeks after he had done this, he got in a fight with his mother. She called the police, and he thought that Obama's minions were coming to take his guns away, and so he killed three police officers when they came up to his door there in Pittsburgh. And this has happened elsewhere as well. There were two deputies shot to death down in Osceola County, Florida, a couple of weeks after Poplawski, by a guy who similarly feared that Obama was going to be taking his guns away. And then, of course, you know, we've had things like the incidents like the Holocaust Museum shooter, as well as Scott Roeder's murder of Dr. Tiller. And I do hear a lot of people say, well, what about all these people on the left? You know, what about all the hateful rhetoric on the left coming from the left? And there is a fair amount of bile coming from the left. I think it's dropped off in intensity since Obama was elected. But it was getting pretty bad there last summer. But frankly, I don't see liberals walking into churches and shooting people in the head. I don't see them, tell me when was the last time a liberal did that? Because I can give you two incidents just in the past year when that's happened from right-wingers inspired by right-wing rhetoric. People who very clearly draw their inspiration from these mainstream rhetorical sources. I mean, in the case of Dr. Tiller's shooting, I mean, Scott Roeder had been clearly listening to Bill O'Reilly talking about Tiller the baby killer for the better part of 6 months. And in the case of Jim David Atkison, the guy who walked into the Unitarian Church in Knoxville last year and opened fire, and the first person he shot was a 59-year-old grandmother, he left a manifesto in his car talking about how he would like to do away with liberals. And let me read a little of this, of his manifesto to you, because I think it's really very revealing, very powerful. He says, "This was a symbolic killing. Who I wanted to kill was every Democrat in the Senate and House, the 100 people in Bernard Goldberg's book. I'd like to kill everyone in the mainstream media. But I know those people were inaccessible to me. I couldn't get to the generals and high-ranking officers of the Marxist movement, so I went after the foot soldiers, the chicken-blank liberals that vote in these traitorous people. Someone had to get the ball rolling. I volunteered. I hope others do the same. It's the only way we can rid America of this cancerous pestilence. If decent, patriotic Americans could vote three times in every election, we couldn't stem this tide of liberalism that's destroying America. Liberals are a pest like termites, millions of them. Each little bite contributes to the downfall of this great nation. The only way we can rid ourselves of this evil is kill them in the streets, kill them where they gather. I'd like to encourage other like-minded people to do what I've done. If life ain't worth living anymore, don't just kill yourself. Do something for your country before you go. Go kill liberals." And this was a guy who, if you read the rest of this manifesto, clearly was getting all of his inspiration from Bill O'Reilly and Bernie Goldberg and, Sean Hannity, the people whose books he had in his house. He had dozens of these books in his house. And if you read the manifesto, it was like basically a regurgitation of all the basic anti-liberal talking points that appear in these books. But he just took it the next sort of logical step. That these guys, that when people take it the next logical step, they don't ever stop to think about what's going to happen, or when these guys write this stuff, they don't think about, well, what is the next logical step of my argument? Well, the next logical step of their argument is, well, we should go out and kill liberals, because that's basically what they're saying. They're saying liberals are destroying America, they're a pestilence on this country, that we'd be so much better off without them, and so on and so forth. Well, eventually somebody's going to take it that next logical step.
Who's Bernard Goldberg that you mentioned?
He's the author of, he frequently appears on O'Reilly's show. He's the author of 100 People Who Are Killing America, or something like that. And so he had a list of 100 people who were bad for America. And that was the list that Atkison referred to. When I try to explain the nature of this problem to people on radio shows, I often refer to a case that took place here in Seattle back in 1986, and a lot of people remember it, and you may well too, Mike, the Goldmark family killings. This was the case where on Christmas Eve 1986, a drifter named David Lewis Rice walks up to the home of a family there in Madrona neighborhood, named Goldmark, and he was the older brother of our current lands commissioner, Peter Goldmark. And their parents had, back in the early 60s, had been involved in a prominent libel case against these John Birchers that were out in eastern Washington, who had accused them of being leading communists. Mr. Goldmark had been actually the Speaker of the House. He was a legislator in Chelan County. And they, so after being driven out of office by these Red Hunters, they sued them and won. Their attorney, incidentally, was, one of their attorneys was Slade Gorton. And, it was a pretty prominent case, pretty famous, but it had gone away, popped back up in the news in 1986, and, the people, now there was this group of people called the Duck Club. And it was a bunch of John Birchers who met, I think, down at Hattie's Hat in Ballard, I'm not sure, where their place was, but it was some, one of the local taverns. And David Lewis Rice hung out with them. And these people had told David Lewis Rice, for the better part of 2 months, that the Goldmarks were these, that the Goldmark family were the leading communists in Washington State, and maybe some of the leading communists in the country, and how they went on and on and on and on about how evil the Goldmarks were. So David Lewis Rice took it upon himself to go murder this family, and he did. You know, he pulled out a gun on them and tied them up and proceeded over the next 8 hours to kill Mr. and Mrs. Goldmark and their two young children in really a horrible fashion. And, you know, he's on death row, but he was mentally ill. Now, you can cop this out and say, well, you know, he was mentally ill. Anybody who's crazy can do this. But the reality is that those people at the Duck Club have, you know, they don't have a criminal or civil liability in this case, but there is moral and ethical culpability for having, for when you fill a crazy man's ideas or head with crazy ideas, you have some you have some culpability for the actions that result. And it's the same thing when Bill O'Reilly goes on the air and tells people that Dr. Tiller has committed 60,000 abortions, which he hasn't, that he's, you know, a baby killer and so on and so forth. Well, eventually somebody's going to go shoot that guy in the head, and sure enough, they did. You know, and he has some real ethical culpability for that. And I think it's, this is where we as citizens have to stand up and make our mark.
So only about a minute left. So how do you propose people deal with this?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of, I think there are various ways of dealing with it. One of them is to, you know, organize boycotts. I mean, the first thing is, you know, you simply stand up and you demand that they either apologize or make some sort of recompense for this clear abrogation of their ethical responsibilities as members of the media. I mean, this is beyond, you know, if you work in media, you know one of your first edicts is to do no harm. And when you do harm, then you have some responsibility to try to deal with it. If they refuse to do that, then it's time to start boycotting them, to hit them commercially, and to stand up to them just as a matter of speech. I mean, this is, we stand up to bad speech by exercising our own rights to free speech, and that's, to me, the fundamental step.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. We're talking with Dave Nyewert. He is author of The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. And in addition to your book, you have websites people can turn to?
Yeah. We have, well, I'm the managing editor at crooksandliars.com. Mm-hmm. We're a pretty popular website. We get over 100,000 hits a day. Mostly known for our video. And I also run my own website called Orsinus, which is at dnyewert, dnyewert.blogspot.com.
Yeah, totally mispronounced that, Orsinus.
That's okay. I had to ask a scientist how to pronounce it myself.
Very good. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Hey, my pleasure, Mike.
Again, just talking with Dave Nyewert, author of The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right.